Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Fat Tuesday, February 28th, Mardi Gras 2006. Laissez les bon temps rouler. I'm Becca Bartleson.
And I'm Brian Smith.
A report released this week finds that Oregon has one of the nation's most business-friendly tax systems. Senate Democrats have declared this week Orange Jumpsuit Week in honor of lobbyist Jack Abramoff. The European Union has drawn Israeli fire after the EU said it would provide aid to Palestine. Portland area weather today, rain north with snow levels around 200 feet, highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s, and tonight showers likely to remain set to the south and decreasing after midnight, temperatures in the low 30s and 40s.
It's Mardi Gras, and in Portland, it's also curfew. Police will enforce a 9:15 p.m. curfew for children under the age of 14 and 10:15 p.m. for kids 14 and older. Portland police advise that if you have youngsters, the best bet is to keep them home tomorrow night.
A timber planner for the Siskiyou National Forest says two more timber sales are planned on land burned by the 2002 Biscuit Fire. Last week, U.S. District Judge Michael Hogan threw out a lawsuit seeking to block such sales in roadless areas scorched by the half-million-acre fire. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports timber manager Rob Scholl saying there is enough salvageable timber to put together the sales, and the National Forest has heard from willing bidders. So far, the burned area has produced only about an eighth of what was expected. The Forest Service says it overestimated the supply and that court delays have allowed some of the wood to decay. Environmentalists say the salvage logging harms the ability of the forest to recover naturally from fire.
Oregon has one of the most business-friendly tax systems in the country, says a new report by the Tax Foundation, a nonprofit group that has been looking at government fiscal policy since 1937. Oregon, which has consistently scored favorably in the annual study, was ranked 10th in the country for the fiscal year. Oregon's score got a big boost from the state's lack of a sales tax. Oregon also got high marks for the Wealth Index category, which measures taxes on wealth, such as property taxes. This, plus the lack of a sales tax, outweighed Oregon's average showing in business taxes and relatively unfavorable rankings for individual income taxes and unemployment insurance taxes. Oregon's taxation of business has long been a hot-button issue. Critics contend Oregon doesn't require companies to chip in sufficiently to public coffers to pay for needed services such as education and public safety. But others say the state's relatively favorable business tax climate fosters economic development and growth. Gubernatorial candidate Pete Sorensen is making Oregon's corporate income tax structure an issue in his campaign. Earlier this month, the Eugene Democrat called for elimination of the corporate kicker, which provides funds to corporations when corporate tax receipts exceed the legislature's projections by 2%. Sorensen said that ending the kicker could give the state an extra $100 million per biennium, which could be used to shore up the ailing community college system.
Australian toll road developer Transurban is perusing construction projects in Dallas, Texas, and Virginia, including the well-publicized $913 million widening of the Capitol Beltway in Northern Virginia. By acquiring the right to collect tolls under long-term concessions, these companies are able to make the projects attractive to private equity investors. Transurban may be coming to Oregon soon. Typically, loan repayments take precedence over equity distributions, but bonding structures tend to permit contemporaneous payments to equity investors. Since bank debt often is sold off on the secondary market soon after the loans have been made, equity investors can usually expect to begin receiving returns relatively early in the term of a concession. How do these companies access the equity capital market? A strategy pioneered by the Macquarie Infrastructure Group, MIG, best illustrates the approach. The scheme combines income-producing assets and investment pools and sells shares in the pools to individual and institutional investors, with the latter constituting 80% of the demand. All three foreign companies are aggressively pursuing road investment opportunities in the United States. The company has bought a franchise to build and operate the South Bay Expressway in Southern California and is pursuing private toll projects in Texas, Virginia, and Oregon.
an environmental lawyer with ties to Eugene, has been selected to head Liberia's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Jerome Verdier is part of the Environmental Law Alliance Worldwide, a Eugene-based nonprofit network connecting environmental lawyers throughout the world. Verdier was one of the founders of Green Advocates in Liberia, a public interest law firm that focuses on environmental and human rights issues. E-Law connects such firms with others working on similar issues around the globe, sharing case law, strategies, and environmental research. Liberia is emerging from more than two decades of war and civil strife that scarred the nation with mass killings, rape, abductions, and the recruitment of children as soldiers. Its infrastructure has crumbled under years of government corruption. Liberia's president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, elected last fall, has been under pressure to form a war crimes tribunal, but opted instead for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to investigate those responsible for a range of human suffering. This from the Eugene Registered Guard.
Governor Ted Kulongoski has enabled unionization of daycare providers who watch children in government-subsidized daycare. Kulongoski signed an executive order February 13th, authorizing a form of collective bargaining for 6,000 state-listed child care workers who watch as many as three children. It's common for daycare workers to earn less than minimum wage. They also pay for children's transportation and food out of their own pockets. Service Employees International Union Local 503, the largest state workers union, spent the past 18 months persuading 56% of child care workers to sign cards authorizing the union to represent them. With the issuance of the executive order, the union now will seek to negotiate better terms for child care workers and the children and parents they serve. SEIU's success comes after its rival, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council 75, organized 4,500 state-licensed child care workers. Those workers watch larger groups of children in their own homes. Kulongoski paved the way for that group to unionize with a similar executive order issued in September. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
A 64-year-old Carlton man was cited for animal neglect over the weekend on accusations that two of his horses died of neglect and that 10 others were near starvation. The horses were removed Saturday and placed in protective care. The Yamhill County Sheriff's Office and the Oregon Humane Society investigated the horse's situation after a neighbor called. Robert Louis Grenier, the horse's owner, is scheduled to appear in a Yamhill Circuit Court on March 7th. This from the Oregonian.
On Tamara and Clay Walker's property east of Bend, a shallow wash bracketed by basalt walls suggests nothing more than a typical desert draw. But closer inspection reveals a legacy of at least 13,000 years of human habitation, documented by more than 200 panels of rock art, obsidian tool bits, and potential burial sites. Northern Paiute tribal members who still worship at the site consider it sacred ground. The Walkers want to place the site, which experts call the most important archaeological site in Deschutes County, on the National Register of Historical Places. The Walkers decided to try listing their land after nearby property owners proposed constructing a rock mine about a half mile from the site. But she said the proposed mine, which has yet to receive a land use permit from Deschutes County commissioners, isn't the only reason to register the site. Adding it to Oregon's roughly 120 other archaeological sites on the historic register could help protect artifacts if the Walkers decide to sell the property. Paul Clay Essens, an archaeologist for the Deschutes and Okono National Forest who knows the site, said the Walkers' effort probably won't stop the mine proposal. This from the Oregonian.
And today is Linus Pauling Day. Pauling graduated Oregon State University in 1922 and is the only person to win two unshared Nobel Prizes. Born in Portland in 1901 and raised in what is now known as the Hawthorne District, Pauling was most recognized for applying quantum mechanics to chemistry and for his advocacy against nuclear testing, both of which earned him Nobel Prizes. Pauling died in 1994 and is most remembered as an advocate for regular consumption of vitamin C. Pauling will be honored at Oregon State University at 1 p.m. tomorrow in Gleason Hall.
State governors are concerned with proposed reductions in funding the National Guard and Medicaid. Two services in the states rely on the federal government to provide for its residents. Governors met with the president yesterday seeking answers but received few. And as FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports from Capitol Hill, budget analysis say that the states should add an additional worry, cuts to discretionary spending such as education.
On the opening day of their convention in Washington, governors met with President Bush. The topic most important to him, national security. The topic most important to the governors, the National Guard. The president acknowledged their concerns. The National Guard makes up nearly 40% of the troops in Iraq. That's a level expected to be maintained. The fiscal year 2007 budget proposed a reduction in spending on National Guard troops. The proposed budget would fund 20,000 less troops than current funding availability. Furthermore, with Guard reductions, governors said that the National Guard, whose duty is to the states, will not be available for state emergencies. Also on governors' minds, Medicaid and Medicare. The president signed into law earlier this month the Deficit Reduction Act that would cut $30 billion from the federal Medicaid program. That cost will be transferred to the states. As for Medicare, states are still seeing problems with the new prescription drug program. And as Iowa Governor Vilsack says, people not receiving their medicine will turn to the states for answers. Governors say states are just re-emerging from a deep recession. Many states accumulated large debts and were forced to cut services and raise taxes. Even though their finances have improved, they say they aren't in the financial situation to take on the reduction of spending by the federal government. In addition to Medicaid, Medicare, and National Guard concerns, a topic not discussed, sure to hit states hard, are cuts to discretionary spending. The president's 2007 budget proposals cut discretionary programs by $16 billion, and nearly half of that is funding that goes to the states to pay for programs such as vocational education, special education, child care, and welfare-to-work programs. And in the five-year budget projection, cuts are expected to become even larger, totaling $183 billion. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Tens of thousands of revelers are gathering in New Orleans for the first Mardi Gras since Hurricane Katrina struck 6 months ago. The festivities reached their height today when tourists and locals lined the street to cheer on the parades. The mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, says the carnival is a chance for the city to lift its spirits. But some residents see it as an opportunity to publicize ongoing problems in poorer districts still largely in ruins. But others have criticized the decision to go ahead. The carnival has been canceled before in times of national emergency. And fewer tourists are attending this year, and some carnival groups are not taking part. The financial crisis has also forced New Orleans to suspend its search for bodies from the Hurricane Katrina, with as many as 200 corpses possibly still trapped in homes. The city may also have to release thousands of remand prisoners because it has no money for jury trials. And local agencies have put the number of Mardi Gras visitors at about 400,000, less than half the normal number. The city's population fell from nearly 500,000 to less than 200,000 after Katrina. The city authorities believe the party is delivering a much-needed boost. The party is due to center on the French Quarter today, but the parades have passed through the areas devastated by the flood, such as the Lower Ninth Ward. This according to the BBC.
Senate Democrats have declared it Orange Jumpsuit Week in a release attacking Republican ties to disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff, whose birthday is tomorrow. The document, which was accompanied by a picture of an orange jumpsuit with the words Orange Jumpsuit Week superimposed on the back, follows: Happy birthday, Jack Abramoff. Today is the disgraced Republican super lobbyist birthday, but unfortunately for Abramoff, his friends aren't in a much of a mood to party. In fact, three Abramoff cronies will be appearing in court this week. David Severian, the Bush administration's former chief procurement officer, has been charged with lying to GSA ethics officer when he said Abramoff was not seeking business with the agency at the time the lobbyist paid for Severian and several others to go on a golf outing to Scotland. Michael Scanlon will be in court on Wednesday for a status conference. Scanlon, Jack Abramoff's partner in the Indian fraud and bribery schemes, pled guilty to conspiring to defraud the United States. Adam Kidden, Abramoff's partner in the Sun Cruise deal, will be sentenced tomorrow for conspiracy to defraud the United States and wire fraud. Furthermore, Representative Tom DeLay, who called Abramoff his closest and dearest friend, we'll see his Texas redistricting plan get some Supreme Court scrutiny tomorrow. DeLay himself is currently facing money laundering charges in Texas. This from Raw Story.
The Coast Guard raised concerns weeks ago that it could not determine whether a United Arab Emirates-based company seeking a stake in some U.S. port operations might support terrorist operations. The Coast Guard cited many gaps in U.S. intelligence. The disclosure came during a hearing yesterday on Dubai-owned DP World's plan to assume significant operations at six leading U.S. ports. It also clouded whether the Bush administration's agreement to conduct an unusual investigation into pending takeover security risks would allay lawmakers' concerns. The administration said the Coast Guard's concerns were raised during its review of the deal, which it approved January 17th, and that all those questions were resolved. The Coast Guard assessment raised questions about the security of the company's operations, the backgrounds of people working for the companies, and whether other foreign countries influence operations that affect security.
A former high-ranking official of Carter's National Security Council, an officer in Naval Intelligence, confirmed the existence of the CIA's remote viewing program and use of parapsychics to locate secret Soviet missile bases and ballistic missile submarines. However, he conceded that both the U.S. and Soviets' remote viewing programs were plagued with problems, including constant interference from third parties. After Stargate's exposure by ABC's Nightline in 1995, it was reportedly defunded. However, according to NSA sources, remote viewing remains an ultra-secret project at the Signals Intelligence Agency. According to those familiar with the program, the protocols followed have actually complied with U.S. Signals Intelligence Directive 18, which implements the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. U.S. persons have been protected by the use of mandatory two-person control, a viewer and a special handler, during remote viewing sessions carried out in a super-secret, secure chamber at NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. With recent disclosures about NSA's violations of FISA by order of the Bush White House, there are concerns that NSA's remote viewing program and longer complies with FISA or USSID 18. This from Wayne Madsen.
The New York Times sued the U.S. Defense Department yesterday, demanding that it hand over documents about the National Security Agency's domestic spying program. The Times wants a list of documents, including all internal memos, emails about the program of monitoring phone calls without court approval. It also seeks the names of the people or groups identified by it. The Times in December broke the story that the NSA had begun intercepting domestic communications believed linked to Al-Qaeda following the September 11th attacks. That provoked renewed criticism of the way Bush is handling his declared war on terrorism. Bush called the disclosure of the program to the Times a shameful act, and the U.S. Justice Department has launched an investigation into who leaked it. The Times had requested the documents in December under the Freedom of Information Act, but sued upon being unsatisfied with the Pentagon's response that the request was being processed as quickly as possible, according to the six-page suit filed at federal court in New York. David McCraw, a lawyer for the Times, acknowledged that the list of documents sought was lengthy, but that the Pentagon failed to assert there were unusual circumstances, a provision of the law that would grant the Pentagon extra time to respond. This from Reuters.
A U.S. company has called on the English High Court to block the controversial $6.8 billion takeover of shipping giant P&O by Dubai Ports World. Eller & Co. claims that the takeover could cost it $150 million and affect up to 1,500 jobs at the port in Miami. P&O's lawyers said the firm's legal challenge was woefully thin. The move came as U.S. politicians also tried to block the purchase of P&O because of security concerns, and port workers protested. Republican and Democratic politicians argue that the U.S. would be more vulnerable to terrorism after the takeover, which would hand control of 21 U.S. ports to a firm from the United Arab Emirates. New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez said yesterday that opposing the takeover was about making sure we keep America safe. In an effort to sue the situation, DPW has agreed to a 45-day review of the security implications. DPW, which has said it plans to push ahead with the purchase, said it was surprised by the turmoil its bid had caused. New Jersey officials are taking legal actions to try and block the deal, while the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is seeking to annul P&O's 30-year operating license, claiming it failed to seek permission for the transfer of ownership. This from the BBC.
A daytime curfew was lifted in Baghdad as Sunni Arab leaders said they are considering returning to talks to form a new government, after walking out last week following widespread sectarian violence in the wake of the destruction of a Shiite shrine north of Baghdad. In this report, produced and narrated by FSRN's David Enders, Salam Talib speaks with residents in Baghdad about the violence and fears of civil war. David Enders narrates and produces.
Faris Al-Abadi is a journalist working for All of Iraq, a news website based in Baghdad. On Friday, he described the violence that followed the destruction of the Askariya shrine in Samarra.
After the bombing of the shrine, which was on Thursday, you could see the armed people everywhere in the streets, and many of them were shooting randomly. It is really difficult time in Baghdad. In the last 48 hours, 130 people have been killed. I went to the morgue in Baghdad, and I saw there was no place to put the bodies. It was full. And they had placed many bodies in the front yard of the morgue. Yesterday, they killed another 48 Shiite in Bakuba when they tried to go to the mosque to gather for a demonstration. So you can imagine that Baghdad and all Iraq may explode at any second. I work as an editor, and I cannot keep up with the news. It is overwhelmingly sad. I feel like Iraqi's blood is so cheap.
Shiites have endured past attacks against holy sites and figures without widespread violence. But some in Baghdad said the conflict had been growing more violent in the weeks leading up to the bombing and the retaliation. Ala al-Hashimiya lives in Harthiya, a mixed neighborhood in Baghdad. He said that the Sunnah Mosque across the street from his house was burned.
For the last 2 weeks, the killings were everywhere. At my workplace, every day, two or three people have been getting killed. These are dark days. We have not faced days like this since the occupation began.
Many caution that Iraq remains on the brink of open civil war, an escalation of the guerrilla civil war that has been taking place for almost 2 years. Though Sunni leaders have said they would consider a return to talks to form the new government, no final agreement has been reached. The events that created the tensions that led to the violence are also not likely to go away. Following the attack on the Askariya shrine in Samarra, Shiite leaders accused of running Ministry of Interior commando units that have rounded up and killed and imprisoned Sunnis pointed to the attack as the reason they cannot give up control of the Ministry of Interior, which functions as sort of a national police force. Hardline Shiite parties giving up the MOI has been a frequent Sunni demand. Many Iraqis also fear what they are saying is the increased influence of clerics like Muqtada al-Sadr, whose Jaish al-Mehdi militia, which fought U.S. and Iraqi government troops in 2004, is blamed for many of the attacks on Sunni mosques. According to some news outlets, militiamen remained in control today of many of the Sunni mosques that were attacked and not destroyed. Sadr himself denied involvement of his militia, and instead called for Iraqis to unite against occupation forces. All sides seem to blame the occupation in part for the destruction and the ensuing violence. Other news reports said Sunnis were fleeing some neighborhoods and that Shiite minorities in predominantly Sunni western Iraq were also fleeing. Though the daytime curfew in Baghdad was lifted, extended curfews remained in force throughout much of the country. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib reporting for FSRN.
A leaked report says that the Mexican government and military committed crimes against humanity in the so-called dirty war against left-wing rebels. The report was prepared for current President Vicente Fox, but has not yet been released. A U.S. NGO has printed material saying Mexicans had a right to know. The army kidnapped, tortured, and killed hundreds of rebel suspects, says the report, which covers 1964 to 1982. Mexico's special prosecutor says the report is biased and has been revised. The draft report's authors write, "The authoritarian attitude with which the Mexican state wished to control social dissent created a spiral of violence which led it to commit crimes against humanity, including genocide." They say they base their findings partly on declassified military, police, and interior ministry documents and list for the first time the names of officers allegedly involved in the abuses. The report says that units detained or summarily executed men and boys in villages suspected of links to rebel leader Lucio Cambanas. Detainees were forced to drink gasoline and tortured with beatings and electric shocks. Bodies of dozens of leftists were dumped in the Pacific Ocean during helicopter death flights from military bases in Acapulco and elsewhere. This from the BBC.
Sharp differences emerged between Israeli and the international community over the acute financial crisis faced by the Palestinian Authority, and as the EU agreed to an emergency aid package of $143 million. The differences are over Israel's refusal to transfer between $50 million and $60 million a month in duties it collects on the PA's behalf, most of which is used to pay salaries, and the increasingly hard line taken by its government against the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. The bulk of yesterday's EU-agreed aid package will go on direct humanitarian aid paid through the UN and other agencies, but the EU will also release $21 million for the salaries which had been frozen in a World Bank trust fund, providing this is spent before the new Palestinian government is formed. Yesterday's EU decision followed a stern warning by James Wolfensohn, a former World Bank chairman and the international community's special envoy, that the failure to pay salaries may have wide-ranging consequences, not only for the Palestinian economy, but also for the security and stability for both the Palestinian and the Israelis. Some European member states, including Britain, had argued against German-led opposition that the World Bank sum should be doubled to help meet the salary bill, and some European diplomats said a further tranche could yet be forthcoming, this from The Independent.
According to the BBC, people across the world overwhelmingly believe the war in Iraq has increased the likelihood of terrorist attacks worldwide, a poll from the BBC reveals. Some 60% of people in 35 countries surveyed believe this is the case, against just 12% who think terrorist attacks have become less likely. In most countries, more people think removing Saddam Hussein was a mistake than they think it was the right decision. About 42,000 people were questioned in the poll for the BBC's World Service. In 20 countries, there is overall support for U.S.-led forces to withdraw from Iraq in the next few months. Only in 9 of the remaining 15 countries do more people believe U.S.-led forces should remain until the situation is stabilized. 6 countries are divided. The removal of Saddam Hussein in 2003 is seen as a mistake in 21 countries compared with 11 countries, where more people view it as the right decision. 3 countries are divided. The countries most eager for U.S. coalition withdrawal are Argentina, Egypt, China, and Brazil. Those which favor troops staying for the time being are the U.S., Afghanistan, Australia, and Great Britain. If that doesn't tell you something, then you just are not paying attention.
Organized shack dwellers in Durban, South Africa, scored a legal victory yesterday. FSRN's Naeem Jina has the story.
Shack dwellers in Durban awoke this morning to police invading their homes and preventing people from moving out of the settlements. 4 people were arrested. The early morning crackdown was because of plans by the shack dwellers movement, Abasali Basem Njondolo, to march in protest against the lack of housing and the poor delivery of basic services. But police were determined there would be no march and prevented people from leaving the camps. Although Abasali had fulfilled all legal requirements to hold the march, police insisted it would be illegal and that their preemptive strike was justified. But Abasali applied for an interdict to allow the march to proceed. By midday, the Durban High Court ruled the march had been and remained legal and interdicted police from in any way interfering with marches. Thousands of shack dwellers marched, thrilled that for once they had won a victory against a municipality that has consistently prevented them from protesting. In a country where there were 6,000 protests last year, civil society groups welcomed the judgment as a precedent for the right to protest by poor communities. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naeem Jina in Johannesburg.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Tuesday, February 28, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news. KBOO News newsroom volunteers and reporters produced and edited the tape. Liam Delta is our engineer this morning. Kathleen Stevenson is AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
And thanks for listening. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR, be sure to join us for the KBOO Evening News at 5 p.m. And you want to know what goes on in the KBOO Morning News? If you have the guts to help make the sausage, volunteer in the AM newsroom and call Kathleen Stevenson at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, rain north with snow levels around 200 feet. Highs in the mid-40s to lower 50s. And tonight, showers likely to mainly be in the south, decreasing after midnight. Temperatures in the low 30s to low 40s. And coming up later this morning on KBOO, at 7:30, it's Talk Radio with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Guests include Melanie Sloan, Executive Director of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and Lewis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine. At 9 on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg interviews G.M. Ford, a crime novel set in Seattle. At 9:30, the focus on words and pictures is a Muhammad cartoon controversy, with international guest Christopher Zeiler from Denmark and Al Jazeera editorial cartoonist Shujat Ali, plus Pulitzer Prize winner Art Spiegelman weighs in on the debate. At 10:15, we'll check in with Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine and author The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. He'll be in Portland next week. At 10:30, on stage and studio, the focus is Our Fathers Who Aren't in Heaven, a look at the African-American son relationship to his father. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Thanks for listening.
And here is the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, February the 28th, 2006. The Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan Association presents an interactive exhibit focusing on the work of and the cultural changes women have had to deal with during decades of war and government upheaval in Afghanistan. The showing is at PSU, 724 Southwest Harrison. Doors are open from 7:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. and admission is free. Come learn about our nation's founding principles at the Liberty Reading Circle. Read and discuss articles, essays, videos, and booklets on liberty. This group is nonpartisan. Learn the difference between a democracy and a republic, why we want one and not the other. This is free, like it should be. Liberty Reading Circles meet at 7 p.m. every Tuesday in the Southeast area. Call for contact information. Call 503-238-6973 and ask for Renee. That was 238-6973. Or send email to renee@enoughwaste.com. I spell R-E-N-E-E at E-N-U-F-W-A-S-T-E.com. There will be a vigil at the military recruiter's office tonight. The Portland Catholic Worker Vets for Peace Chapter 72 invites you to join the weekly vigil at the military recruiter's on Northeast Broadway. That's tonight and every Tuesday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. The address of the recruiters is 1317 Northeast Broadway in Portland. And that was the KBOO Community Calendar for Tuesday, February 28th, 2006.